Troy, as we look at some of the different challenges and mystiques and misunderstandings that are out there, I would think tides, sneaker waves, all that kind of stuff are almost mystical for a lot of us. You know, when you go north, you get these big swooping tides, and closer to the equator, okay, you get less. Kind of makes sense. But beyond that, do we really know, not you guys as the pros, but us guys, do we really know what tides are?
Well, there's some mystery to the tides, even for folks who study them and know a lot about them, to be honest. So some behavior of the tides is still not completely explained. So there's different time scales and physical scales that tides operate on. And, you know, just the temperature of the water, the ocean, can make the tides higher or lower based on the temperature. So if we have an El Nino year, for example, versus La Nina, we can see a difference in the actual tide levels.
The median tide or the mean will change, or just the extremities of the tides?
The median, right. The whole thing can shift up from warmer water, for example. But,
really?
But it can be more complicated than that because it can shift the currents, and currents have an impact on tide. Yeah, tides are kind of complicated, but there are some basic things that we know, and I often find myself clarifying for folks. But I have to mention before we get started that we established this topic exactly 14 seconds before this interview started. So that's a great credit to you to come up with a topic on the fly, because this is an interesting topic and I wouldn't have thought of it.
Well, we'll find out what your answers are, whether or not it's an interesting topic.
It's interesting to me. We'll see if we can make it interesting to your listeners.
Our listeners, baby.
But for folks out there that don't know how quickly you can come up with a topic, I want to share with them. But yeah, that was very quick. And I think a lot of people are puzzled by the tides. And so one of the things I often hear from folks in areas like King Salmon when it's flooding, that the rain is making the flooding worse. Like the tide is high because of the sun and the moon, and that's bad enough, but then by golly, that rain is what's pushing it over the top. Now, it just so happens that we have a lot of big tides in the wintertime because of the orientation of the sun and the moon and our proximity and the angle, but we also happen to get storms in the winter. So those two things happen to happen at the same time pretty frequently, but it doesn't mean that one is causing the other. So the rain that's happening on the bay and around King Salmon is not actually enhancing the flooding that happens in King Salmon. When the ocean has risen high enough to inundate Perch Street in King Salmon, it's doing it pretty much all on its own. It just so happens that the storm that's bringing the rain is also bringing south winds. And you know, when we used to have a lot of smokestacks, the locals would say you knew a storm was coming when the stack was blowing to the north, because the wind was out of the south. And a south wind is what happens before a big storm comes. So if we get a sequence of storms that hit the coast, one after the other, when you have protracted periods of that south wind, even if for a period of time, then it switches to the north and it goes back to the south. But if we get in that sequence, slowly but surely, that can set up an elevated water level throughout the region by a really cool process called Ekman transport. Basically, the south wind forces the water onto our beach.
Kind of pushes it up.
Pushes it up. And so when we have a lot of south wind, we get water that's higher, just stays higher. So lower tides are lower than they would have been, and the high tides are higher than they would have been based on the tide table, which is the predicted tide that's really just based on the location of the sun and the moon.
Now, we also will get, not storms, but we'll get winds out of the north.
Yes, and it has the exact opposite. In the summertime, we have a lot of north wind. If you look at the tide prediction versus the observed tides, you'll see the observed tides are consistently coming in lower than the predicted tides. So we predict a 7.5-foot high tide. It comes in at 7.2 feet in the summertime.
So that's enough.
Yeah.
That 0.3 or, what, is that 4 inches? Duh. A 4-inch difference. Now, is that recognizable?
Yes. No, and that's an example in the summer. But no, it definitely can add up. So we can get as much as a foot of extra water just caused by the wind.
That's
a pretty extreme scenario. Yeah. But when you look at areas like King Salmon or Jackson Ranch Road up in the North Bay by Arcata, you know, they flood if we start hitting somewhere in the 8 or above, 8.2, 8.3. Put a foot more on top of that. Now you're talking about 9-foot tide. It can make a big difference to the flooding.
Now, how much influence does the moon have? In November, I think we had, I don't know what it was, big moon or large moon or what. Does that also make a recognizable difference in the tidal cycles?
Yeah, the moon is the big driver. Yeah. In fact, it's kind of complicated and not necessarily entirely intuitive. And I have some props normally to explain this, but the moon pulls the ocean towards it. And so you get a high tide when you see a full moon. That means you're looking up at the full moon, right? It's above you where you're sitting. And so there's a high tide there. But it turns out there's also a bulge on the other side caused by that process, because it's pulling the water towards the moon, but it's also pulling the planet towards the moon and leaving some of the water lagging behind. So the best analogy or the best visual is a rocket ship driver with tons of G-forces, right? You picture they're sitting in their seat and their flesh is being pulled to the back of their head. Some of that's actually happening when the moon is pulling the Earth itself. So there's two bulges caused by the moon, one on the close side of the Earth to the moon, that's the bigger bulge, and a little bit of a bulge on the backside as the moon is pulling the Earth out from under that water that's on the other side. And we have a Nerf ball prop. That's excellent. That's what trips people up, though. It's like, wait, I have a high tide on the full moon, but there's a high tide on a moonless night, too. Well, that's because you're experiencing
The backside.
Now, that's the lower of the two big tides you'll get in that scenario. See, they're complicated.
Yeah, it's making sense. That's really frightening. KINS, yeah. News and Information Times, 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music. ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and The Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio. Easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music. Easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:23. We're back to talk shop this morning with Troy Nicolini from the Weather Service, the island.
The island, yeah.
Yeah. That's got to be kind of intriguing when there's some of these larger tides or higher tides to see right there. I mean, it's not like you're in downtown City X.
We're surrounded by the bay.
Jungle. There it is. You go, yep. Yeah, okay, it's happening.
Yeah, and as you drive over the bridge to get to the island, either from the Eureka side or from the Peninsula side, you can look down and see the other islands underwater. You know, Indian Island or Gunther Island, whichever you call it.
It's
most of it's submerged on those really big tides. The next one coming up, of course, is the weekend of the 1st. We have an 8.876, I think. Dang it, it's on memory. But it's a really high tide. I think it's the highest tide of the year.
So what triggers that? Is that just the Earth's rotation again? Is that what's called the king tide?
That's a king tide.
So is that a rotational thing, or is that a combination of circumstances?
It's a situation where the sun and the moon are in their best position to cause the highest possible tides, and they're both contributing to the same high tide.
So what happens when you go north? Let's say now we're in Alaska.
Yeah, these are king tides in the northern hemisphere. So they
really get some huge...
Well, you know, when you hear about really huge tides, like the extraordinary tides, normally when you ease your way into this topic of tides, the best way to envision them is an Earth covered with water. And then they're really simple, right? And then you stick continents in the way. And so those really big tides are actually a result of the continents disrupting the really simple tide patterns that we might see if we had nothing but water. So those are not necessarily because they're farther north, because we can get some extreme tides in various places throughout the country. It's more
but
just...
But not 30-foot or 35-foot like they have in
Alaska. Those are the shape of the continent and the landform and how it interrupts the tidal flow that causes an enhancement of the tide in those really specific locations.
So that's a compounding factor.
Yeah, okay. The land is causing. Yeah, not just because it's farther to the north necessarily. Yeah.
Okay. So
the continents really mess it up.
That's what I was wondering. With the continents as they are, does the width of the body of land make any difference?
Totally. And
so like the Isthmus or Baja.
Yeah.
Do they have the same types of tides as the mainland does?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, but I'm guessing they would be pretty different, like the Sea of Cortez, or it would be different than the Pacific side. I haven't looked at the tide differences, but they can vary a lot. Just on our coast, in fact. That's why they're also sort of counterintuitive, because our maximum high tides around here are not the same as you get in Crescent City, for example. We're in a bay, and we have the bay influences. So,
protection.
Yeah.
So when there are these heavy tides during rain season, you said, okay, King Salmon's not going to get it. Fields Landing's not going to get it. There are the areas. Every time I'm driving back and forth, go across the Klamath Bridge. That's roughly about where the tidal influence is on the Klamath.
Right.
When we see
during low flows. That's what really messes with people's minds. And so when you look at the river gauge at Klamath, which is just a little bit upstream of the bridge,
right.
During the summertime when the flows are low and the tide is going up and down, right?
So see the tidal influence.
You'll see
more.
A bleep every 6 hours, as the high tides come and go. But in the wintertime, the power of the river, the momentum of the water flowing through the river, actually overpowers that tidal influence.
It pushes it closer to the ocean.
Yeah, closer, exactly. Well, man, you could have been a hydrologist. Yeah, that's exactly what happens. But many communities who are near rivers that flood will have almost an institutionalized, I guess that's not really the right word for a social network, cultural belief that their flooding is enhanced by high tides. And so,
like it's on top of.
Exactly. The flooding they're seeing is actually caused partly by the high tide blocking the river's ability to flow out to the ocean. So when I first came up here 20 years ago, I heard that. Every river on our coast has that belief associated with it. It's actually in our formal documentation at my office, or it was, I should say. For the rivers that I've been able to be there during a flood and during a tidal cycle and explicitly measure the river, I've been able to show that there's no tidal influence during large floods. And so for the Klamath and for the Navarro, we've struck on that from our documentation. Those are the two I've been able to be on scene. It usually requires sleeping in my vehicle all night, getting up every half an hour, putting a marker in and marking it with a life vest on because I'm close to the flooded river, to be able to show that during the entire tidal cycle, all you see is the river rising and falling. You don't see any tidal signature.
So if you've got two for two.
Yeah, two for two.
Couldn't you just project that into the Smith and the Med? And
yes, and the exception might be like the Eel. If the Eel might be, I have to prove it for each river, especially to be able to pry people's beliefs off of that old understanding.
Because the terrain is just specific.
Every river is
to
different,
that.
Yeah. So if a river flattens out before it hits the ocean, then its momentum is diminished and it might be more tidally influenced. So
sure, like the Eel in the Delta
area. The
Eel
has a big flat delta. Yeah. It could be more tidally influenced farther up the river. That's going to be a really hard one to document because to get to the edge of it during a big event would be dangerous. So
yeah, the sheriff's kind of discourage that.
Well, so do we. So it's a little awkward. I'm in my NOAA logo there. We have some classic footage of a NOAA person at the North Jetty trying to get some video of big waves. And the camera's on the big waves, and you see this in the footage. And then you hear, oh, no, as a big wave comes. And then all you see through the lens is obviously the ground as the person's running with the camera to escape the wave. So we use that as training of what not to do.
That's why we have long-range cameras, guys.
Telephoto lenses, right. Yeah, exactly. I shouldn't have admitted that, should I? That's internal footage that we use to remind people, you don't want to be the victim.
At this point, just put it on your website and not worry about it.
There you go. There's no secrets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I would think that there is a lot of lore because of the tribes, because of a lot of the logging early on. It's funny for me when I say the big flood. And you go, okay.
You mean 64. Yeah, that's the year I was born, so I never forget that
55?
One.
No. 1855.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And nobody knows about that. Or the 1913 and the 31.
It's the most big recent. Floods early, yep.
Yeah. So when you're looking at some of that stuff, does that influence any of the water information that you have?
Yes. People, we do something called frequency analysis. When I say the Weather Service does it, other parts of the Weather Service. And then engineers use this information, but frequency analysis is important because if you're going to build to protect a community from a flood, you want to know what level of protection should you build for. And so those old events factor into projecting what the future is going to hold in store for us.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
What could we do as a community to make Humboldt a better place to work and live? The answer is to make sure our kids are literate, able to plan financially, move forward in their education so they are better prepared to enter our workforce, and become contributing and productive members in our society, community, and economy. How do we do it? Through the Decade of Difference Initiative. Visit decadeofdifference.org and find out how you, as a parent, student, or business owner, can help. It's the Decade of Difference. Be part of it.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:35. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with meteorologist in charge. Ooh, bet you didn't think I remember that part, huh? Troy Nicolini. Talk Shop presented by CDH Painting, REDEC, and by Lolita Cheese Factory. Troy, the concept of tides, of water, of anticipating and forecasting kind of gets into the realm of pixie dust for a lot of us.
Well, statistics.
Smokes.
It's a field of statistics that troubles everybody, yeah.
Well, and you know, statistics are, okay, it's black and white, it's numerical, it's logarithmic, you punch it in the computer and pff, there you go. It's that other part that is the mystical for a lot of us. Does that become intuition, experience, office knowledge? I mean, where does that stuff come from so... While the modeling may be saying one thing.
Oh, I see.
The other stuff is, you know, guys, you probably want to consider this.
That's it. That's an area of interest for me because there's our forecasters who've been here for 20 years who do have some intuition and like a gut feeling sometimes, you know. Or if you watch NCIS, Gibbs has a famous gut, right? You know, is the person lying? You know, what's your gut say? Well, is the model lying? And we do have gut feelings, our forecasters who've been around for a long time. And I place value on that. I think there's great value in that. And, you know, the computer models continue to improve and get better, but there's still a great role for human judgment and experience to play. And we have some really, many really good forecasters in our office who do add that extra element. And some of it is still scientific and rigorous, but some of it, you know, you might say starts to drift into the realm of, you know, it's an art.
Which to me makes a ton of sense. I mean, that's also experience. That's all these other things that are part of it, because if it was so predictable, you guys wouldn't have a job.
No, exactly. And interestingly, you know, prediction, there's economic prediction, there's weather prediction. In many of those disciplines, I believe, most practitioners believe there's a science part of it, a rigorous part, and there's a, you know, a talent part, a skill, an art part that come to bear. Certainly in weather forecasting, there's no doubt about it. And then the other side of that, though, is for me, being around here now for 20 years in the early days, hearing that people who are outside a lot, like commercial fishermen and women who are on the ocean a lot, start coming up with ways to sort of anticipate what the weather is going to, how it's going to impact them based on their experience. And many scientists want to discount that. I find there's great value in it. I think that they see and experience things that the models can't, and even a forecaster who's sitting in an office behind a model can't. And so I think that there's great value in hearing what folks who are out in the world see and feel and experience. And
simple things like upwelling, you know, or gee, there's a lot of crab. There's a, you know, the fish are moving differently. Yeah. I mean, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and one, I'll give you an example, a very explicit example. There isn't a commercial fisherman out here that I know of, or woman that I've ever talked to, who would disagree with this. That when the wind has been blowing strong and the tide changes, the wind often diminishes. Now, there is no physical connection I can come up with. And it may very well be just a correlation, like I said, between the tide and the reigning king salmon. But it is incredibly consistently referred to by people who spend a lot of time on the water that happens. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if someday a scientist figures out that there's a causation there. We'll see.
Somehow, some way, yeah. It's kind of like the seagulls used to fly.
Yes.
You knew a storm was coming when they were flying from the dump downtown because you knew things were getting ready.
And some of those lore-based predictors, red sky at night, sailor's delight, red sky in morning, sailors take warning.
Yeah.
There's actually really clear physical reasons why those things make sense. In certain parts of the country, they get flipped if you go to a different hemisphere.
But yeah, if you're in Wyoming and you say that, it's kind of...
Yeah. But it is an interesting element of our work. And computers, you know, we're always looking for ways for computers to help us do our job better. But nobody has figured out a way to completely get the human judgment out of the forecast process yet. And I don't see that happening in my lifetime.
When you are talking to the folks in the hills, because I know you've got your different gauge stations all over the place, do they have different insights like what you're allowing that happen at the ocean level, at the mouth level? Do they also have that experiential to give?
That's a great question, and I don't know. I don't hang out with them as much, frankly. Like that, you know, my circles I run in outside of work are on the waterfront. Like I went up to the hills to cut a Christmas tree. I did get a Forest Service permit. It was a great experience for our son. Although it was pouring rain and we had to load three kids and three dogs back into some trucks. That was pretty fun. But that I don't really spend as much time with the folks in the hills. So if any of your listeners have contact me, I'd love to hear. If there's something we can learn from their experience being outdoors in that environment to help us forecast better, we always want to hear about it.
How accurate are the rain gauges? The river gauges, I mean, out there? Do they give you a lot of information, or sometimes do they make it a little bit more challenging as you're trying to figure out what's going on?
You know, our partner agency, the U.S. Geological Survey, maintains those gauges. And I used to work closely with them when they were co-located in our building. There's a lot that goes into trying to make sure that those gauges are giving us the best possible flow information. And I'd be happy to go over that in more detail.
He tries to be so smooth. KINS News and Information Time hits 8:41. We'll be back with more from Troy.
What's the shopping show all about?
If you haven't listened to the show before, it's kind of tough to describe.
I guess the easiest first step is to simply go to the shopping show website.
Theshoppingshow.net.
And join us this Saturday for the next shopping show.
On KINS 106.3 FM.
KURY FM 95.3 and 101.3 in the Illinois Valley.
And KEKA 101.5 and 100.9 in Eureka.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:45. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Troy Nicolini. Troy, before the break, you were talking about, we were starting to touch on river gauges. And I was thinking river gauges, wind gauges, any of these things that are mechanical-based. Maintenance, buoys would be another one. Is the reliance on these things such that it's almost too much?
Well, many of them are really accurate. Like every instrument that we use has, I mean, different instruments have different vulnerabilities to inaccuracies. I will start off by saying observations are really valued by the people who make decisions about weather, and rightly so. You know, you want to project out in the future and plan something, whether it's roofing a house or pouring concrete or going commercial fishing. And then as you get closer, you want to confirm. So for example, we say it's going to be dry tomorrow. You get all ready to pour some concrete and you wake up, it's pouring rain. Okay, well, the forecast may have been wrong, but that doesn't mean you go out and still blindly pour concrete in the rain, right? So what's happening in the moment, we really support people making that final decision based on what they see in observations. With that said, they're very expensive to maintain. Like buoys are particularly expensive. We have to drive ships out there, big ships. It's very expensive to get them on location here and then get them ready and fuel them to go out. You know, some of our farthest buoys are 600 miles offshore. That's a really expensive trip. But they're really valuable. And buoys, for example, are particularly accurate at measuring waves. I mean, they're really a good tool for measuring waves. Wind, pretty much too, you know, usually. You mentioned river gauges. River gauges might be some of the most labor-intensive gauges. And if folks don't know how they work, all they're doing is measuring how deep the water is. But what we're predicting and what is meaningful for everybody trying to anticipate a flood is what the flow is, how much water is actually coming down the river. And so to do that, we have to have this magic called a rating curve that translates a flow into a depth or a depth into a flow. And the USGS is the agency that maintains those. And so they actually go out to all of our area rivers about 10 times a year, and they measure how much flow is happening at a given stage, and they come up with one data point that they put on a curve. And they want to do that for a wide variety of flows so that the National Weather Service can take 3 inches of rainfall, put it on the watershed, predict how much flow is coming off the watershed, go into their rating curve and tell you how deep the water is going to be, and more specifically, whether it's going to flood your road, your house, your business, or your community.
Now, so, is there an allowance in that, Troy, for dry, which is going to have a higher absorption rate, or
in the
saturated?
Hydrology part, yes.
Yeah,
we have a computer model that tries to model how a watershed behaves. So the very first rain of the year, the watershed, we have it in a computer model, it describes it as very dry. And as the rain falls, everybody experiences this, right? Rain's falling, nothing's running off. Well, it's going into the soil. So we actually, the model has parameters. They're sort of almost can be visualized as buckets. And so the bucket is like represents the soil's capacity to hold water. And so it has to rain a certain amount to fill the soil up until it can start running off. Yeah, so that's a good question. It's a very complicated process. There's the meteorology part to predict how much rain. There's the hydrology part to predict how much of it soaks in, how much runs off. Then there's traveling down the river and then translating that into a flow or a depth based on the USGS work to tell someone, look, your house is going to
move.
Your house is going to have a foot of water in it tomorrow afternoon. There's a lot that goes into it.
The timing of that is also something that's always been very curious to me.
Yes.
Is that just a byproduct of all these other computer systems or programs?
Yeah, we can go out about 5 days with a forecast for what a river's going to do based on projecting the rainfall.
5 inches of rain at Honeydew.
Yeah.
Okay. How long is it going to take before it registers at Fernbridge?
Oh, I see what you're asking. Yeah, so we actually know, our computer model for the rivers knows how long it takes a river to respond. So all rivers have a response time, and bigger rivers typically take longer to respond. Smaller, steeper rivers respond really quickly.
So it's the gradient and the drainage?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep, and so that's part of the river model. It's interesting to look at different scales. We have some really small, steep rivers around here, or even creeks, right? And then we have the Mississippi. It takes 2 months for a raindrop that lands somewhere in Pennsylvania to get to the Gulf of Alaska. It's a long travel time. So we have rivers often around here that respond between 6 hours, 12 hours, 20 hours. And then in those regions, those rivers respond in 2 months.
And then flushes through.
And flushes through.
Yeah, that's the thing I think for a lot of us here that haven't spent much time in the plains is how you get a flood. Okay, here it's over in a day and a half. There, it's 3 or 4 weeks.
It goes
weeks.
On for a long time.
Yeah, yes. Just so yep. Different.
So we have something to be thankful for in the North Coast.
One day more by day, hour by hour.
Yes.
Thanks for coming by,
My pleasure. Great to be here.
See everybody tomorrow.